Okay, this is the Genesis series, and today is January 13th. Okay, we're working on Noach. I think that's page 31. Okay, what did we get last time? These are the products of Noach, not generations. What he created. He created his own spiritual character. And the repetition of the name Noach means he created himself. We said that there's a contradiction between righteous, whole, pure, or perfect on the one hand, and in his generations on the other hand, because righteous, whole, pure, and perfect are absolute terms, and in his generations seems to make it relative. And we said there were two solutions. Either in his generations is not really relative. What it means is he was righteous, whole, pure, complete, perfect, in spite of his generations, even in those deteriorated generations, which adds to his praise. Or it means that they aren't really absolute terms. The Torah is telling us he deserves these titles only by comparison to people in his generation, which reduces the praise. And we asked, what would be the motivation for giving an interpretation that reduces the praise? Isn't the context praising him? Especially if you have a perfectly good interpretation that adds to the praise, why would you want to opt for an interpretation that reduces the praise? And we started to answer that by analyzing he walked with God. We said he walked with God is too vague to have any specific meaning. It's not clear what it's supposed to indicate. But since Chanoch walked with God and lost about 600 years, it's clearly at least equivocal to walk with God. Is it good? Is it bad? He lost 600 years approximately. And in speaking to Abraham, God is on record. He tells Abraham to walk before me, not to walk with me. So it seems that walking with God, although it definitely is praiseworthy, it's definitely good, but it isn't the best. It has a weakness, a fragility about it. That's beginning to see a little bit of weakness. And I want to follow out that thread, looking for weaknesses in Noach, in the text, so that we can justify the one who says in his generation should be used to reduce his praise. That's where we were up to last time. Now, take a look at page 33. Chapter 7, I want you to look at verse 1 and verse 7 only. Look at verse 1 and verse 7, read them together, and tell me what you see. This requires precise reading. And a little thinking, not a lot. Yeah.
Two things. One, it sounds like the ark's already built, and it says, you and all your household, because you were the one that was righteous before me, but his household wasn't.
What does it got to do with verse 7? I said to read verse 1 and verse 7. You're taking verse 1, and you're importing other matters, but I'm asking you to compare, contrast, put together verse 1 and verse 7. Mm-hmm. Okay, you've got the right idea, though you're not putting it with precision. The first... No, it's worse than repeating itself. It's almost contradicting itself. Yeah. Okay, you had the right idea, but you're not paying careful enough attention to the words. In the first sentence, it doesn't say why you should go in. It says, come in. 7 says specifically, why did he go in? Because of the waters. What would you have expected? He went in because God told him to go in. Here, God says go in, and he goes in because the waters are up to my neck. That doesn't sound right. It doesn't even sound right if the only two verses in the entire Bible you knew were verse 1 and verse 7. If you know the style of the Tanakh, it's even worse. When someone is told to do something and he follows orders, the Tanakh indicates it one of two ways. Either it says, and he did as he was told, he did so, that's not written here, or it repeats over again what it was told, what he was told to do. He did X, Y, Z. That's not written here either. What's written here is the third thing. So it's very peculiar. Sounds like God's command wasn't enough to get him to go in. He waited until he was forced in, which doesn't sound too good, actually. Okay, now another thing. Take a look at verse 18 at the top of the page. Same page, 33. I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. That verse is written in an extremely peculiar way. No one today would write it that way. What's wrong with the verse from the point of view of today's mores? Verse 33, page 33, verse 18 at the top of the page. Yeah, the order is very, very peculiar. You, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives, no one would ever write it that way today. Now look at verse 7 at the bottom of the page. How do they go in? Same order. Noah and his sons, his wife and his sons' wives. I can hear the critics now waving the political flags. Women to the back of the bus. You know, women are always second class. As usual, that would be in ignorance of some of the important extra material. Take a look on page 39. Verses 15 and 16. You and your wife and your sons and sons' wives. Now look at 18. Hello, Davarhu. Something's going on here, right? And don't tell me that the scribe was dozing by the fire and couldn't remember wives, sons, sons, wives. You know, let's make it interesting with this shift of couple around here. Give me a break. The text is trying to tell us something here. What the text is saying on the simplest level is this. God tells them, go into the ark. The whole world is going down the... It's going to be destroyed, right? When the world is being destroyed, don't you engage in creativity. You have to register the destruction. Go in, men and women separate. And they went in, men and women separate. Now, when they're told to come out on 39... they're being told, come out, get back together, and repopulate the world. I'll prove it to you. Go back to 39. Look what it says. 15, God spoke to Noah, saying, go forth from the ark, you and your wife, your sons' wives with you. Every living being that is with you, of all flesh, birds, animals, moving things, moving the earth, order them out with you, and let them teem on the earth, and be fruitful, and multiply on the earth. So clearly, the intention is, that now I'm saying men and women should go out together so that you'll get back together and repopulate the earth. Well then, if that's true, how do you explain 18? Where they come out separate. What 18 is saying is they didn't do it. They didn't do it. Which again indicates some kind of weakness here. Whatever the explanation is, we'll come to the explanation. But there's a weakness here. He goes into the ark only because of the water. God tells him to go out together, men and women. They don't do it. We're seeing a bunch of misses here. Then, the most striking, on page 43, at the very end, 20, bottom of the page, Noah, the man of the earth, debased himself and planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk. And was uncovered. There's no reason to translate it, he uncovered himself. Was uncovered within his tent. Comes drunk. This man, on the basis of whom the whole human race continues, righteous, pure, complete, walking with God, ends up drunk. That's a big weakness. So, if we're looking for a reason for the position that, in his generations, reduces his praise and makes those seemingly absolute terms relative, there's plenty of indication here that Noach has weaknesses. Right? We don't have to go too far in the text to find that there's a string of weaknesses. Now back to 31. There's still another implied weakness. It's at least implied. In the instructions to make the ark. God said, 13. God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with robbery through them, and behold, I'm about to destroy them from the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood, make the ark with compartments, cover it over with pitch. This is how you should make it. 300 cubits, the length of the ark. How big is a cubit? It's about 20 inches or 22 inches. Let's see, 300 cubits, we're talking about 475 feet. 500 feet? That's a big boat. Even Donald Trump would be happy with a 500-foot yacht, I think. Right? 50 cubits wide. That's about 90 feet wide. Right? 30 cubits high. That's about 50 feet high. Five stories high. This is a big box. It's a gigantic box. Right? How long do you think it would take to make a box like that? Years and years and years, even decades. We're talking about construction methods 4,000 years ago. Now, the oral tradition asks, why did God tell Noah to make a box? What's the box for? What will you tell me? To save them from the flood? Ribono shel Olam, the flood is a miracle. If he wants to save them, he can save them the same way he's bringing a miraculous flood. Put them in space. Put them in suspended animation. Let them float on the surface of the waters. What difference does it make? They don't need a box. And indeed, the Ramban, 850 years ago, points out, listen carefully to this, the box wasn't big enough. The ark wasn't big enough to hold the people and the animals. You don't have to be a modern biologist to know that there are 30,000 species of beetles to know that the box wasn't big enough. Our tradition has that long, long before modern biology calculated them. Numbers of species. So even fitting into the box was a miracle. So what do you need the box for? Now, Rashi says, this is the reason God told him to make the box. Because people will see him making the box, and they'll say, oh my gosh, that's a gigantic box. You're working on it for decades. All that material, what's it for? And he'll say, you're all wicked, and God is going to bring a flood to destroy the earth. Maybe they'll reconsider. Maybe they'll reconsider. Now, I'm going to say it again and listen to the implication. What's being implied about Noah in this description? Noah, make this box. You know why? Because while you're making the box, people will come and ask you, why are you making the box? And you'll tell them, because there's a flood coming. Maybe they'll reconsider. What does that say about Noah? Say again? They already believed? Yes, that's true. Say again? You're pushing fairly subtly. I'll come back to what you're saying. It's quite interesting what you're saying. But on the surface, make the box so that people will ask you, so that you'll tell them, implies... He wouldn't tell them otherwise. He wouldn't volunteer to tell them otherwise. The box is to trigger their asking, so he'll respond. Which means that somehow, being told the end of all flesh has come before me, Noah's attitude seems to be, okay, it's your world, you're running it, you know, what's it to me? Now, this is Rashi, this isn't in the text.
But what is in the text, glaringly by its absence, is that Noah doesn't pray for them. Noah doesn't ask for mercy for his generation. When God tells Abraham that God is going to destroy 5 isolated cities, Abraham is up in arms with an argument against them, with a plea for mercy for vicious, wicked people. Here, God tells Noah, the whole world is going down the drain. Not a word, not a murmur of protest, nothing. So again, we see, I think, a kind of weakness here. Now, the lack of prayer is glaring, a glaring aspect of the explicit text. Rashi's going a step further by saying this was the reason for telling him to build the box, but the two are both indications of the same attitude. He's suggesting something else, which isn't in Rashi's words, but it's a possible further explanation. I'm just deducing what I'm saying from Rashi. Suppose, these people at Hyde Park on Sundays in London, you know, who have all these weird messages. He come out with a sign and say, the end is coming, you know, get your raincoats out of mothballs. It's going to rain, you know, it's going to be a flood. No. But if you spend decades and decades building a box, and the box is designed with wood and with pitch, sealing it and so on, that people will think about it more because you're taking considerable effort to prepare for it. I think you're right that this would be a kind of visual demonstration to hit people harder than just saying so. I think you're right that that's part of the point of it. But I'm bringing my implication for what Rashi says the point is. All he says is that if you'll make it, people will ask you, and you'll tell them, and then they may turn around. So in all of this, I think we see considerable weakness in Noach. Not to say that he wasn't great. He was very great, and the whole world continues through him. But there's considerable weakness. Now, one last remark about Noach. This one is very subtle. Take a look at page 25. These, again, are the begats. I told you, this is the boringest stuff in the entire Tanakh, and all of it's gold. Every word, every letter is gold, and here you're going to see something quite subtle, which we owe to the pre-tzaddik. Here you have a series of generations, and there's a formula for each generation. Look at 6. The first three sentences for each generation. First says he lived a certain number of years and begot the designated successor. Shez lived 105 years, begot Enosh. The second sentence gives you the rest of his life, 870 years after beginning Enosh, we got sons and daughters. And the third sentence sums it up. All the days of Shez, 912 years, and he died. And so it is, generation after generation. That's what you have on this page. Now, if you look at the end of Parshas Noach, on page 51, here you have a string of generations. Each generation gets 2 verses, which are identical to the first two verses on page 25, and the third verse is just left out. 12. Arpachshad lived 35 years, begot Shelah. Arpachshad lived 403 years, that's beginning Shelah, begot sons and daughters, without summing it up. What's the difference? Why is one string of generations one way and one string of generations the other way? Of course, you could always say that they were different writers and different times, and, you know, this one was going to the movies. You can make up whatever you like. But the Brit Tzaddik says that the first list on 25 is before the flood. It's the end of the Parsha of Genesis. And here, it's after the flood. And the difference is that the vast, vast, vast majority, almost everybody, who was born before the flood, their descendants died in the flood. They got cut off. Whereas here, these people, they had sons and daughters, they joined the growing human population and didn't get cut off. That's why in Genesis, the end of each one is the third verse, which says that these and these were the sum total of his years, and he died. He's removed from the stage. Here, they're not removed from the stage. They lived through their continued generations because they're not going to be cut off again. Okay, given that explanation, what do you expect for Noah? What kind of generational description of Noah do you expect? A 2-sentence or a 3-sentence? He dies after the flood. He lives 350 years after the flood.
Now take a look on page 45. Verse 28, the middle of the page. Noah lived after the flood 350 years, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. He gets the pre-flood description. Does that associate positively with some other fact you know about Noah? How many people left the ark after the flood? Eight. Noah and his three sons and their wives. What happened after that? Where did the new human population come from? Only from his sons. Noah lived 350 years after the flood and had no children. Last time I checked, 350 years is time enough to have lots and lots of children. Something cut him off. What the Torah is telling us is that essentially Noah is a pre-flood figure. He doesn't really survive the flood. He doesn't really survive it. He hangs on, but he doesn't really survive it. He ends up drunk, can't function, can't focus, can't build, can't create, doesn't have children. And the Torah gives us the pre-flood designation. He is a pre-flood figure. Right? Very powerful, I think. Very powerful indication in the text. Yeah.
Does that mean that his sons, which were obviously born pre-flood, don't count as him living on?
You're asking the right question. I would say, in a certain sense, that has to be true. Now, of course, they are his sons, and they are going to continue but he, let's put it this way. It's a good question. The truth is, as I was saying it, I thought of it. What happened? It's very interesting. They were born after he got the instruction to build the ark. So he's already started building the ark, and he's already set against his community, against his culture. They grow up in isolation. So before the flood, they're cut off together with him. They have no children before the flood. They're like suspended, waiting for their role after the flood. So if I look at them and I ask, what role do they play in the development of history? They play the role of creating the world after the flood. He plays the role of creating someone who can recreate the world after the flood. And he does that. Once he's finished with that, he's out. So now, their identity of creating a post-flood world doesn't express him. It's like the disconnect. Right, so they are his children, but they're just like one step removed. There's not a natural connect or natural flow together. Yeah.
Wasn't there an incident that happened that prevented him from having
children? Even if so, even if there is an incident, why did that incident happen? What does it say in terms of divine providence that he should end up with that incident taking place? It's not going to change anything. Now, the final question that I want to just mention: why did he end up drunk? What happened to him? I don't know any clue. I don't know of any clue. I must say, I don't study Midrash carefully. Maybe there are lots of Midrashim about it. My Rebbe, Boston Rebbe, offered a beautiful explanation. Two factors together crushed him. Number one, he comes out of the ark, and the whole world is destroyed. There's nothing left. And he realizes that he didn't do anything to try to prevent it. He didn't pray to God, plead with God. I'm sure he answered the questions that people asked him because of the box, but he didn't go out on a campaign to try to stay there, and he's crushed with guilt. And number two, you probably know from history books, after the Second World War, there were Jews who went back to Germany to live out their lives. These are older Jews, 60s, 70s. They went back to Germany. After Germany engineered the deaths of 6 million Jews, how could they go back to Germany? The answer is, without the German language and without
bands playing in the park on Sundays, and without the Wiener Schnitzel, they can't live. They're displaced persons, even in England, which is 98% German anyhow. But it doesn't matter. They couldn't manage to survive. They had to go back to the culture. Otherwise, it was impossible for them to find a locus in which they could function. Okay, we've seen this with our own eyes. Imagine Noah coming out, and there's nothing left. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to connect to. It's all gone. His children don't have that problem because, as I said 3 minutes ago, they grew up sequestered. They grew up divided from that world. They were never part of that world. But he was part of that world. Okay, was part of it, against it, interacting with it, struggling with it, but it was his locus. It was his environment. And now that it was gone, so the combination of being a displaced person and also feeling the guilt of not having done more crushed him, and therefore they ended up as a drunk. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it seems in the pasuk that it happened right away, but it must have taken at least like a year for him to be able to create a great vine and create all stuff, right? So the city never recovered at all, and he was drunk forever.
It does seem that way. I mean, it says he started with that. That's what Chazal say. The first thing he has to do is work on making wine. Yeah. Okay, that's a little background on Noach. Now, let's take a look back on 39. This is what we said about the order, sons and wives. A little thing is crucial for understanding the next three pages. If you have this on board, you can understand the dynamics of the discussion. If you don't, it's really opaque, if you pay attention to it at all. 18 says, Noah went forth and his sons, his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every living thing, every creeping thing, every bird, everything that came out of the family, out of the ark, by their families. The animals came out by families. Only the people didn't do that. Okay, now, Noah builds an altar and offers sacrifices. Shem smelled the pleasing aroma, whatever that means. Shem said in his heart, that means he said it to himself and didn't communicate it to Noah and his sons. I will not continue to curse again the ground because of man, since the imagery of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I continue to smite every living being as I have done, whatever that means, it's not my interest at the moment. Continuously, all the days of the earth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer, winter, day and night, shall not cease. No more general destruction. I'm saying that for a reason. We'll come back to it in Yitzhak Hashem. No more general destruction. That's what God says to himself. But he didn't tell this to Noah. Now, God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the land. I gave you a hint. You didn't take it. Okay, now we'll be explicit. Verse 1 is a blessing. It's not a command, it's a blessing. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the land. Now the next 2 through 6 is all sorts of instructions, which I'm not going into now. 7 repeats, and you be fruitful, multiply, team on the earth, and multiply on it. That's a direct command. Now I have to teach you something very important in terms of biblical style, which, and by the way, this piece of style, I suppose, would be relevant in other forms of literature as well. Verse 1 says, God bless Noah and his sons, and he said to them, it's a whole long speech. Verse 8 starts, and God said to Noah and his sons. Who was talking up until now? Who was talking in 1 through 7? God was, right? And 8 starts, and God said to Noah and his sons. Why repeat it, do you think? Why repeat if it's the same person speaking? And it gets worse and worse, because if you look in the next page, verse 12, and God said, and 17, and God said to Noah. Yeah.
Either a reply we're not party to, or it's said at a different time.
Okay, they're separate speeches. Put that very well, because that the reply part was what many commentators say. They're separate speeches. Had it been one run-on speech, you wouldn't have to repeat, and God said. It means they're separate speeches. So, if they're separate speech and the same speaker is speaking, one has to ask, what happened in between the two speeches that makes the next speech the relevant thing to do. This is all part of one story. They're coming out of the ark, and it's a question of repopulating the earth. I know it's one story because when you get to verse 19, at the end of the story, it says these three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was spread out. So finally, we're going to get there. In the meantime, we're getting there. And there are four separate speeches. So, back to 41. Speech number one is a blessing, be fruitful, multiply, and a command, be fruitful, multiply, with other materials in between. End of speech. Now, let's see what the next speech is and figure out what in between motivates the next speech. God said to Noah and his sons with him, saying, as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you, with your offspring after you, and with every living being that is with you, birds, animals, every beast of the land with you, of all the part of the ark, every beast of the land, I will confirm my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never shall it be there a flood, the translation I'll fight with later, to destroy the earth. What does this speech do that the prior speech doesn't do?
It seems that they didn't want to have more kids because of fear of another flood.
Good. Very good. What does this speech do? This speech, the second speech, shares with Noah what God said in his heart when he observed the sacrifices and said, I'm not going to bring any more general destruction. Yes, I changed the translation. Here, in the second speech, he says to Noah, I'm telling you, I'm making a covenant with you, with all flesh, not to bring another general destruction. This is part of the process whereby God is moving him to agree to repopulate the world. The implication is that this was one of the barriers. Just as he says, this is one of the barriers. What's bothering Noah? Well, Adam and Eve, made by God himself, put into the Garden of Eden, and the world ended up destroyed. Forget it, you know, it's over. The experiment, it was a failure. Can I start now with third-class material? We can predict the outcome. The outcome is certainly going to be a failure. So God says, maybe you're right. You know, maybe we can't hope for a better result, but I'm not going to do this again. I'm not going to bring a general destruction on the world again. That's why. That's the second speech. End of speech. Now, in the third speech, God puts a sign. He says there's going to be a sign of his covenant. What's implied? That even after the second speech, he's not prepared to do it. God tells him, I'm making a covenant. There's not going to be another general destruction. It's not enough. He's still not willing to do it. Doesn't will to do it. Let's see the third speech in detail. God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I give between me and you, of every living thing that is with you, to generations forever. I've set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. And it shall happen when I place the cloud over the earth, the bow shall be seen in the cloud. I'll remember my covenant between me and you and every living being among all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be in the cloud. I'll look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant of God and every living thing, all flesh is on the earth. The rainbow. The sign of the rainbow. A little detail. Were there no rainbows before this? Rainbow was created by laws of physics. Must we assume that God changed the laws of physics at this point in history? Says the Malbim, no. You don't have to assume anything of the kind. All you have to assume is that it always rained at night. No rainbows at night. And indeed, the Talmud tells us that when the Jewish people were faithful to God, it only rained Wednesday night and Friday night, which means there were no rainbows. All you have to assume is that they're changing weather patterns. That's a lot less than changing the fundamental laws of physics. Okay, so one doesn't have to require the idea of the laws of physics to change. Good. 12 to 16, God says, I'm making a sign. I'll see the sign, whatever that means. I remember. A sign of my covenant. 17 is another speech. So it means even after announcing the sign in the cloud, they don't do it. God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have confirmed between me and all flesh upon the earth. What does 17 add that 12 to 16 doesn't have? You have to read carefully. I'll tell you what Chazal say, and you see if you can justify it. In 17, he shows him a rainbow. He shows it to him. He sees it with his eyes. 12 to 16, he didn't show it to him.
How do you know?
Well, what Chazal say is the word this in 17. When you say this, there's got to be something that you can point to. This is the sign of the covenant. What about 12? This is the sign of the covenant. The exact same words. And Chazal say in 17, it means that he showed it to him, and in 12, it does not. Now read 12 carefully, a little bit more, and figure it out. It's not difficult. The answer is not difficult, yes.
So not there's a difference between the living beings, that in 12 they're with Noah, and in 17
that's not. True, but it's not relevant to this. Why is the this in the beginning of 12 not a demonstrative of showing him the rainbow, and the this in 17 is a demonstrative demanding that the rainbow should be visible and seen? Don't see that there's a, because it's hell be in the cloud. It's worse than that. I mean, it's, or it's better than that. The answer is if you read 12 and 13, so you should have the answer to my question. You don't need to go so far. You're just not you're not paying careful attention to the way the words work.
It says Hashem said Noach.
So what? What's it got to do with whether this is a demonstrative demanding the existence of the rainbow, or it isn't a demonstrative demanding the existence of the rainbow? The Chazal is saying that in 17, when it says this is the sign of the covenant, the rainbow must have been visible to be able to point to. And in 12, when it says this is the sign of the covenant, the rainbow is not visible, and you can't point to it. It's the same word.
Well, in 13, it says it shall be a sign.
It's more on the surface than that. Okay, this shall be. Okay. Because he says nasati also, that I gave. I put it in. That's past tense.
In 17 says that I have confirmed.
No. You're not just not paying attention to this. Suppose I write, this is the solution. 2714. What does the this refer to? It refers to the following words, 2714. Right? If you wrote it with punctuation, it would be, this is a solution, colon, two dots, and then the words, 2714, and the this indicates the words that come after the colon. Sometimes a this in a sentence indicates the words that are coming up. Not something outside the sentence. Not something in the living room or in the sky or in the arena. Here he says, in 12, this is the sign of the covenant. What is it? You see, at the end of 12, your helpful, friendly translator puts a colon, which is correct in this case. I've set my rainbow on the cloud, it should be a sign of the covenant. The this in 12 indicates verse 13. But in 17, you don't have that. In 17, it says, this is the sign of the covenant. Which is? What is? There's nothing for this to refer to in 17. That's why Chazal say in 17, he showed it to him. Whereas in 12 and 13, he didn't show it to him. It's just reading carefully. Chazal read very, very carefully. And they teach us, hopefully, if we pay attention to them, to read very, very carefully. It doesn't make any difference to whether this refers to a symbol in the sky or whether it refers to the next coming words. It doesn't make a difference for that. It makes a difference, but it doesn't make a difference for that. Yeah.
13. Why does it say that it shall be a sign of covenant between me and the...
Okay, there's lots of things I'm skipping on. I want to get one idea here. Now, let's stop and reflect on what we've learned. God gives a hint when they leave the ark, get together. No, siree. God gives them a blessing and a command, get together. No, siree. God says, I'm not going to bring any more destruction to the world. No, siree. He tells them that there's going to be a sign of the covenant in the cloud. Nothing doing. He shows it to them, and they're ready to go. The next words are, the sons of Noah who came out, Shem, Ham, and Yafes. These three were the sons of Noah. From these, the whole world was spread out. What are we supposed to learn from the idea that with all of this encouragement, from direct prophecy from God himself, they're not willing to do it, and then they see it, and they're ready to go. You know, it's a sky show. Let's suppose they have doubts. They have doubts about the promise. Okay, God promised, but who knows? Maybe God's promises have hidden clauses, which they sometimes do. And therefore, maybe it's not really absolute, and we're not confident enough.
with showing you a sky show with some colors in the sky change your mind? Is that more evidence that it's really going to be kept? It's just irrelevant. What we learn here is a principle in Torah in general, and there are several places where it's written explicitly in the Psukim, that a person may have psychological resistance. Even if he knows something clearly, without question, without any doubts, he intellectually grasps it and is certain of it, he may still have psychological resistance. And that psychological resistance can often be broken by an experience. Knowing by virtue of certain information, infallible information, is not the same as seeing it with your own eyes. Even though when you see it with your own eyes, you don't learn anything you didn't know before. It doesn't become any more certain, there's no more extra information, but it has an impact on the person's psychology that learning it, even from a perfectly reliable source, doesn't have. A smoker goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, 2/3 of your left lung is shot. Okay? That'll have an effect. If he shows him an x-ray where 2/3 of it's black, it'll have a much bigger effect. The x-ray is no more reliable than the doctor, so the doctor is showing it to him. Maybe somebody else's x-ray, maybe they made a mistake. No. But he sees it. The seeing of it has a psychological impact that the other doesn't have. We have a number of examples of this. I'll take you through one tomorrow where I got this from in the Ramban, but I'll show you a short one now. Look on page 67. Ramban is with Moshe Rabbeinu at the burning bush, and I'll do that tomorrow, Yisrael Hashem. Abraham complains to God, I have no offspring, no one to inherit me. Verse 4, suddenly the word of Hashem came to him and said, that one shall not inherit you, only he, mistake in the grammar, that shall come forth from within you shall inherit you. And he took him outside, God took Abraham outside, and he said, gaze now toward the heavens and count the stars if you're able to count them. And he said to him, and you want to note who's head to who? God said to Abraham. Wasn't God talking to Abraham just a moment ago? So this is a separate speech, right? A separate speech. God said to him, gaze toward the heavens, count the stars if you're able to count them. And he said to him, a separate speech. So the commentators say, God told Abraham, count the stars. He says, okay, yes, sir. You know, whatever you say. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Trouble with counting the stars, as you know what a clear night is, you can't check them off and say, I counted that one already. How do I know which one I counted, which I didn't count? Right? They're all pressed together, and they sort of, shift in and out and fade in and out. You can't count the stars. It's not possible to count the stars, not without telescopes. So he says to him, count the stars. Are you able to count them? And Abraham starts counting. And if you're able to count them, well, okay. Then he gives up and says, I can't count them. And he said to him, so shall your offspring be. Now, why does God put Abraham through this charade? Abraham is a shepherd. He's been shepherding flocks for decades. You know, you don't have the smoky lights of Tel Aviv getting in your way and cutting off your vision of the stars. Abraham knows what the stars are like. Why doesn't God tell him at noon, Abraham, you're worried about offspring. I'm promising you, you'll have offspring as many as the stars. You remember what the stars looked like last night, Abraham? And the night before that, and 1,000 nights before that? So will your children be. Why does he have to take him outside at night and tell him to count and wait till he tries to count? When he can't count, then tell him your children will be like that. If Abraham had reason to doubt what God is promising him, will looking at the stars make it more certain? Will it add evidence? Will it be more probable because while God's saying it to him, he's looking at the stars? It's just not relevant. But if you talk about the psychological impact, if Abraham is going to feel confident, feel secure, other than just knowing it, looking at the stars can have a big impact. Because even Abraham, as we'll see tomorrow, the Ramban says, even Moses, hearing it directly from God, even Moses, seeing it has an effect on his psychology that hearing it direct from God doesn't have. This is a very, very important principle in Jewish psychology. A person can know something without any doubt whatsoever and still not act on it appropriately. Could still not act on it appropriately. For those who know, it means that Aristotle was right and Plato was wrong. Akrasia is a real phenomenon. Weakness of will can cut off a person's actions even when his knowledge is clear and without a doubt.
Which means, if you want to improve, if you want to elevate yourself, it's not enough to learn the truth. It's not enough to learn the truth. One has to undertake a program of implementing the truth psychologically, because learning it alone will not do that.